But we head back to July of around 1864 for our next talk. We are joined by retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters. He's a veteran of the intelligence world. You may see him as a strategic analyst on Fox News. But in most of his time, he writes the novels of Civil War battles and exploration. His latest one is called The Damned of Petersburg. Ralph, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning to you, and thanks very much for having me on.
We had you on once before, one of your other previous books.
Yes.
And this one deals with the Petersburg, Richmond. It's taking place in sort of the latter parts of the Civil War. Take us, I guess, maybe a synopsis to set us up where we are at this point in your stories.
Yeah. Well, this is part of the fourth and a five-book cycle that goes from Gettysburg to the end of the war. They do not have to be read in order. And they're really dramatized history and very historically accurate. And this one, The Damned of Petersburg, deals with the most brutal phase of the war, just savage fighting, a place called the Crater during the Siege of Petersburg. Well, that battle's fairly well known, but the grim, truly gruesome details of it are not known. And then you have lesser-known battles that really, each of which, whether the Union won or lost, each was a nail in the coffin of the Confederacy. Reams Station, Globe Tavern, Peebles Farm, Deep Bottom. People don't know those names anymore, but they were incredibly dramatic, fierce battles. And to me, it's very important to get beyond the well-known characters as well to the fascinating people on both sides who fought this war. I mean, they were complex, even often very eccentric. One brilliant Confederate division commander, Little Billy Mahone, and he was a little guy, he had stomach problems, so he travels through the whole war with his own cow to give him, you know, milk and buttermilk, and with his own pastry chef to pamper his stomach. But he's a ferocious guy. And you have Francis Channing Barlow, who's also in some of the earlier books. He's a Harvard valedictorian, class of 1855. He's a general in his 20s, a division commander, and turned into one of the most savage killers the United States has. Harvard was a little different then, I think. But it goes on and on. But The Damned of Petersburg is really two things. One, it's an exciting read about our Civil War, the reality of the war, not the romanticized nonsense you often get, but the reality. But the secret agenda I have is to teach Americans about the reality of our past, because a disastrous mistake we make was taking serious history teaching out of our schools, taking civics out of our schools, and a people, voters who don't know the past, fall prey to demagogues, right or left. And I'm trying, in a way that's entertaining, to also help educate Americans about the terrible price we've paid to get where we are today.
Many times in your books, and this one included, you kind of deal with those who are literally in the trenches, and sometimes you can understand their confusion as to really what's going on. You know, we read about sort of the battle strategic, looking at it from that aspect, talk about all the generals, those on horseback, and sometimes those down below, what did they know, and how did they get that information, and kind of looking into their minds as they're going through this horrific deal.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. I'm glad you raised it, because too often we concentrate only on the generals, and I try to also, we have started out as an enlisted man, as a private in the Army, you know, cleaning latrines with the other privates. So I know where it's coming from. I've done line work, staff work, so I understand the military. And yes, the experience of the privates and sergeants and junior officers is critically important, and it gets ignored. And the irony is that we have tremendous records. This is a very literate generation on both sides, especially in the North. So we have letters home, we have diaries, later on we have memoirs, and great sources. And so in these books, every figure, right down to the sergeants and privates, are real historical figures. And everything they do and say is based upon their letters home, their diaries, etc. Because I'm really trying to get at the reality of it. Again, I also warn people that if you want a prettied-up romantic view of history, or if you want a slant of history, left or right, just skip my books. Because these books are as honest and objective as they can be, as accurate as they can be, and sometimes the truth is pretty ugly, including what life really was like in the trenches of Petersburg for both sides. And I'll tell you, among other things, it smelled pretty bad.
Well, you talk about it even in the opening sequence of here related to flies and rats and how you're encrusted with whatever bodily functions have taken place while you've been in battle. And it kind of puts people in a point where they're thinking, I'm glad I don't have to go through that, at least now.
Yeah, I mean, on that first opening scene you're referencing, I want people to feel the shock of the heat and grime and what it was really like, even when they weren't shooting at each other. There are battles in the late summer of 1864 around Petersburg and Richmond where soldiers die before they get in the battle. They're dying from heat stroke. Southside Virginia is pretty tough in the summertime. And so, again, all the things that are left out, you know, staff work, planning. I mean, armies don't get to the battlefield by magic. And in the Damned of Petersburg, I'm trying also to bring out the rivalries, the personal feelings generals had. I mean, we look back and say, well, why did they do something that stupid? It's easy for us to judge with perfect hindsight, but the general or colonel who made that decision, or captain, might not have slept for 2 or 3 days, might have had dysentery, aggravated diarrhea, or just a toothache. He doesn't have the complete information we have in retrospect. And all these people are doing the best they can with limited information, exhausted soldiers, dealing with sickness and heat, and fighting for a cause they believe in. And that's another point to me. Although I'm a Yankee-born Pennsylvanian, Pennsylvania and Ohio played tremendous, really, you know, enormous roles in this war. I'm a Yankee-born, but I go to great lengths to be fair to both sides. And if you're reading my Civil War novels, when I'm writing about the Confederates, you should be seeing it through their eyes and feeling what they felt. When you're reading about the Yankees, you should be cheering for the Yankees. I mean, I'm trying to be even-handed. And it's very important that the one sin that I detest in historical novels is when people put our modern politically correct views in the minds and words of the people of the past. You know, no, the language in my books is the language those people used, and it can be harsh to our ears. And no, they didn't all speak like Victorian parsons. So if you don't have a strong stomach, you don't want to read my dramatizations of the Civil War, because they are, again, accurate and brutally honest, and some people can't take it. They want the past to be a fairy tale. It wasn't.
You mentioned learning from the past. What would you say would be the primary lesson we need to learn from this book, this battle?
Well, from all these Civil War books, you know, this was a war that was started by loudmouth firebrands, but fought by men just doing their duty. Yeah, especially in the South, a lot of the guys that were screaming for secession never went to war. They stayed home. I mean, there were politics in the state legislature or the legislature in Richmond. And so many Southern generals, starting with Robert E. Lee, but Wade Hampton, Jubal Early, they opposed secession, but they felt the duty to go with their blood kin, their family, their state when secession came. And you say, I have this paradox about a man like Wade Hampton, the classic Southern Cavalier, one of the few who were truly noble figures from an incredibly rich family. And the war that he didn't want, that he resisted to the end, he goes out, he's a brilliant cavalryman, and it turns into a devastating personal tragedy for him on many levels. And part of that comes out in the book. But, you know, I just feel like the past is not a guide. It's not a how-to checklist for the future. But it informs our decisions if we know what the price we paid for mistakes in the past was. And also leadership. You know, there are a lot of pop books about leadership, you know, 10 Steps to Perfect Leadership. It's nonsense. You know, I'll tell you from my military experience, enlisted an officer, the best way you learn about leadership is by studying good leaders. And so this is very much about leadership. And the problems are amazingly similar to what we saw in the past. For example, we think we're the ultra-modern folks. You know, no generation's ever been like ours. We've got the Internet. We've got smartphones, high-def TVs, cars that virtually self-drive. Well, for the two generations, the leaders and the led, that fought the Civil War, that was a revolutionary time. They saw the rise of steam power. Suddenly, you can cross the Atlantic. You're not subject to the eccentricities of the climate and the wind. Railroads are spanning the continent. The telegraph collapses distance for the first time in human history. Humans can communicate over thousands of miles in virtually real time. it's a time of wonders and amazement. Medical advances are really taking off. Not all Civil War doctors were drunken butchers, and the TV shows get it wrong. And so you learn about that. You learn about, though, when it comes to leadership, there's always been a struggle between modernizers and traditionalists. It was there in the Civil War, too. You see it. The old West Pointers, think of Napoleon and Frederick the Great, the younger generals who've come from civilian life without the West Point preconceptions, often turning to be the best battlefield commanders, like John Brown Gordon or Francis Channing Barlow. So there's that tension. There are incredible personal rivalries that influence outcomes, and it just, you know, it goes on and on. The past, to paraphrase William Faulkner, the past isn't even past. Yeah, and especially in the United States today, it's amazing how much of the Civil War and its problems, its legacy problems that weren't resolved, remain with us today.
And that's things that we have to deal with. And, you know, in the Civil War, the battle they started, or the war that started and the war that ended, sort of, I mean, it evolves, and that's, I guess, any war you go into with one sort of ideas, and then once it's underway, not to paraphrase the thing, but it's sort of like a sporting event where you have a plan of what you want to do, and then once you're into it, you think, okay, how do we get out of this, or what can we use to our skills to get a victory in any way possible?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And in many wars, the goals change. You know, the South starts out fighting for its independence, and in the end, it's fighting for its survival. For the Union, which didn't want the war, it's an incredibly explosive time of growth. I mean, it's a paradox that wartime often leads to these huge business booms, to growing prosperity. For the South, it was economically devastating, although the South did recover quicker than Gone with the Wind legends would have it. In the North, though, the North, and, you know, this 1860s in Europe and North America are a revolutionary decade. I always say it's the 1860s begin in the London of Dickens and end in the London of Trollope and modernity and commuter trains, etc. But at any rate, with our Civil War, the North emerges as the, you know, proto superpower. It's just become incredibly wealthy. The cities are booming. Trade is booming, and nobody expected this. I mean, the outcome is so radically different from what people expected, including how long the war took. You know, people did think, as in World War One, they thought, oh, it'll be over by Christmas. Instead, it turns into 4 years of gruesome war, and some of the most gruesome fighting is in the new book, The Damned of Petersburg. But it ends up killing about 740,000 Americans. We used to think only 650,000. We really relooked the records, and looked, 740,000 dead Americans. That's far more than Americans than died in World War II. And of those soldiers and some civilians who died, more died of dysentery, aggravated diarrhea, than died of bullet wounds. I mean, it was absolutely brutal, and so I try to honor the past and the people who fought that war with honesty.
The book is called The Damned of Petersburg. Our guest today is retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, author of this book and many other novels about the Civil War. Ralph, we thanks for your time this morning and your little insight into the military.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much for your time. Thanks.